So a few months ago, our country, especially people in the Southeast, were unbelievably worried, and you probably remember this. You may not have been as concerned as we were, but there was something happening in the Caribbean that threatened the Southeast especially. There was a hurricane forming on the hills of Hurricane Harvey that devastated Texas. This hurricane named Irma was making a beeline toward the state of Florida, which for most of you here doesn't mean a ton because you have the advantage of living much farther north. For those of you that are geographically challenged, you don't have to worry about that. What you have to worry about here is that you guys don't have fall. You have fell. Okay? It happens like that. So we in the Southeast, I'm from Atlanta. My wife and I and our family was especially concerned about this path because our oldest daughter goes to college and plays basketball right where that number two is on the path. We had just taken her back to school 2 weeks before, and now Irma is making a beeline, and it looks like it's going to split Florida right in two. And so what do you do when it's bad weather? You watch Jim Cantore religiously. And so we start watching the Weather Channel. And there was one particular day, Pastor, where I'm watching the Weather Channel just hoping and praying that there's some sort of shift and it banks out toward, you know, the Atlantic or something changes. And Jim Cantore and all of his cronies are in the, you know, standing there waiting for it to hit. And on this particular day, for whatever reason, the governor of Florida made it his aim to make sure that he warned Floridians that they needed to evacuate, especially people who lived in Key West. In fact, five times in about a three-hour span, as I was working and watching the Weather Channel, the governor of Florida came on, did a live press conference, and he said explicitly, "People of Florida, you need to evacuate." And there was one statement that he kept making over and over and over that I thought was brilliant. He kept saying this, that you can rebuild your home, but you can't rebuild your life. You can rebuild your home, but you can't rebuild your life. And there's an unspoken implication in what the governor of Florida was saying to the people of Florida. That there was something that was happening in the minds and the hearts of people who lived, especially at the tip of Florida, that their belongings, their material things, were much more important than their life. So much so that many of them had decided, we're not going anywhere. And I know that to be true because the day before landfall, I live in Atlanta, a radio station in Atlanta did an interview with a grandmother from Key West, Florida. And they asked her, are you going to evacuate? And for those of you that don't know, even though Irma was not as strong as they thought it was, it did a number on Key West and devastated it and destroyed it. But they asked this grandmother on the radio, are you going to evacuate? And she said, and I quote, "This ain't my first rodeo. I ain't going nowhere." And then they asked her, have you done anything to prepare? And this is what she said. Yes, I brought my garbage cans in. Now, for those of you that have never been in a hurricane, a garbage can in 140 mile an hour winds is no longer a place to put your trash. It's a weapon of mass destruction. But in her mind, she had done everything that she needed to do. And while you and I sit there and we giggle and we judge, isn't it easy for all of us in this room? It is really easy for anyone to lose perspective about what matters most. Because in Edwardsville, you could sit here and think, evacuate. But you don't have a house in Key West. And if we're not careful, the same principle holds true for us spiritually. Because all of us sitting in this room today all have different perspectives as it relates to our relationship with God about what it is that God thinks matters most. And it's not really difficult to determine what you think God thinks matters most, because how your life generally exposes what you think God thinks matters most. And when you read the pages of the New Testament, what's interesting is that religious leaders were constantly trying to get Jesus to make a statement about what mattered most. They did it because they wanted to paint him in a corner. You don't paint baby in a corner, and you don't paint Jesus in a corner. But they were doing it trying to get him to say something that they could use against him. And one of the classic things when you read the gospel accounts of the life of Jesus that they constantly asked Jesus was this idea as it relates to what matters most. They would ask him, what's the most important thing? What's the greatest commandment? And here's where Jesus stumped the religious leaders. Because Jesus answered it this way when they asked him, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus said, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. This is the first and the greatest command. And the second is just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. And to the religious leaders, they had no response to that. But there is this account in Luke chapter 10. When an expert in religious law tries to begin to play Jesus in a way. Here's what happens. We have this account in Luke chapter 10. One day, an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus, which isn't a good idea. Now, granted, we have the advantage of revelation in retrospect, but in that time, people thought they literally could corner Jesus. So an expert in religious law decides he's going to test Jesus by asking him this question. Teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life? So the teacher of the law says to Jesus, what is it that I have to do to have eternal life? And Jesus replied to him, because Jesus was very keen. Jesus said to him, what does the law of Moses say? How do you read it? In other words, you're an expert in religious law. You know what the law of Moses says. How do you read it? What is it that you think that you should do to inherit eternal life? And most biblical theologians and historians believe that this is where the man gives himself away, because he answers Jesus the same way that Jesus had answered religious teachers or religious leaders, the Pharisees. He answered him by saying, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. A Pharisee answers Jesus the way Jesus had answered the Pharisees, which tells us this. There's a very good chance that that religious lawyer or that, you know, teacher of the law or expert in the law had heard Jesus talk about this before. It's a setup. It's a setup. And so he answers Jesus by saying, I think that what Moses' law implicates is that we should love the Lord our God with our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. And I love Jesus' reply when he says that in 2017, Jesus would have said, dog, right on. You got it. You go and do that and you will have life. That's unbelievable. And in my mind's eye, you get this picture that Jesus says, that is so unbelievable. You do that and you will live. And he turns to do something else. And the religious leader says this to him. Excuse me, Rabbi. But who's my neighbor? But who's my neighbor? Now, let me tell you why that held weight. For those of you that don't know, Jesus grew up and did ministry in and around Judea with Hebrews, with Jews. And in the Jewish faith tradition, there were 600 plus Levitical laws that had been added to the Ten Commandments. And one of those 600 plus Levitical laws that had been added to the Ten Commandments was a law about your neighbor. And here's what that law stated in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. The law stated this: do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite. Let me say that again. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite, but love your neighbor as yourself. So when a Jewish expert in the law hears Jesus saying, and love your neighbor as yourself, when he asks, and who is my neighbor? Here's what every Jew listening heard. The only neighbor I'm required to love is somebody that is like me. A fellow Jew. I have no responsibility to love anybody else, treat anybody else with kindness, except somebody else that is just like me. And let me tell you why that holds weight for us today. Because of what Jesus did next. Because for those of you that don't know, as soon as the gentleman said, and who is my neighbor? Jesus began to tell a story that has survived the annals of time in history. And it is recorded, it is held up, it is championed by politicians, by Christians, by Jews, by Hindus, by those who embrace the Islamic tradition. It's the story that you and I know commonly as the Good Samaritan. Here's what Jesus says as soon as he asked him, and who is my neighbor? Jesus says, well, let me tell you a story about a guy who was on his way to Jericho, and he gets jumped, and he's beaten unrecognizably, and he's bleeding, and he's dying on the side of the road. And a priest comes by, and when he sees this man desolate and dying on the side of the road, he goes to the other side of the road and keeps going. And when a rabbi comes by, he sees this man dying in the middle of the road, and he goes to the other side of the road, and he leaves him there to die. But a Samaritan comes by, and he sees him, and he picks him up, and he bandages him, and he washes him, and he makes sure that he's going to survive, and he puts him on his donkey, and he takes him to a hotel. And when he gets to the hotel, he cares for him some more. And then he gives the innkeeper money and says to him, whatever he needs, you pay for it, or I'll pay for it later. Just make sure that this man survives. And after Jesus says that part of the story, he looks at the religious leader, the expert in the law, and says, so do you tell me this? Of these three people in the story, who's the best neighbor? The rabbi? The priest or the Samaritan? And you get this sense that the expert in the law is like, crud. The Samaritan. And Jesus says, you go and be like him. You go and be like him. And that story to all of us here begs two immediate questions. And the first one is this. To the people who were listening, the reason why that story was so bothersome is that the idea that the word good and a Samaritan could be used in connection with each other was an impossibility. Good Samaritan to Jews was the equivalent of diet chocolate. It does not exist. And for those of you that don't know why Jewish people had such a horrible perspective of Samaritans, let me tell you why. Because at one point in Israel's history, 10 tribes of Israel were captured and taken to Babylon. The Assyrians invade Samaria. They bring a population of Assyrians and Babylonians to live in Samaria, and they begin to intermarry. And so that's where the idea to Jews that Samaritans were considered half-breeds. Their race, the Jewish race, was being tainted. Furthermore, when these Assyrians and Babylonians moved into Samaria, they also brought their pagan religions. And so the one true God was now intermixed with all these crazy pagan religions. So there's intermarrying, There's these half-breeds in the minds of Jews. They're no longer thinking that the one true God is the one true God. Now they have all these pagan religions. And the only reason, ladies and gentlemen, that it remotely broke up, this is true. History tells us that in Samaria, after this intermarrying and all the pagan religious worship had started, there was an outbreak of lion attacks. Lion as in Mufasa, that lion, okay? There was an outbreak of lion attacks, true story. And it scared the people who were running Samaria, the Assyrians and Babylonians, so much that they sent to Babylon to get a priest to come back to Samaria to make sure that the one true God wouldn't be angry and keep sending lions. And at that point, the faith system got really, really jacked up. They no longer believed. They believed in the Torah, but they didn't believe what the prophets were saying. They no longer believed that Jerusalem was the holy city. They believed it was Mount Gerizim. It also became a place where all of these outlaws, all of these people who were outcast in Jerusalem and surrounding areas, would flee to. So when Jesus says, it's a good Samaritan, the people that were listening were going, there's no way there can be a good Samaritan. But let me tell you why that's important to us today. I would submit that America is a whole lot more like Samaria than it is Jerusalem and Israel. But the second question is where we really got to go tonight. And it's this. What happened? What went on with the rabbi and priests when they were growing up that they could know so much and miss it? How could this rabbi and priest grow up the way that they grew up and miss it? So theologically correct. And so relationally numb, so spiritually connected, and so kindness void. And my question to us is, do you tend to lean more toward a Samaritan or to the priest and a rabbi? And maybe it even begs a bigger question. Because when you think about it, Jesus' model for the right kind of neighbor was a theologically incorrect, morally inferior, racially despised, half-breed Babylonian that most Pharisees would have never invited to dinner. And here's what that says to all of us in this room. There's hope. But if we're not careful, we can miss what Jesus was really pushing at. Because what he was really pushing at was this. What would happen if you and I, if we decided to make what Jesus thinks matters most, the thing that matters most in our lives? And that is, are you ready? How you treat the people around you. How you treat, how you love, how kind, how compassionate you are to the people around you. Where are the parents in the room? Are there any moms and dads? Raise your hand and be proud of it. You brought life into the world. Congratulations. The reason we're hesitant, for those of you that don't know, is that parenting is like trying to fold a fitted sheet. It is the hardest thing in the world. It's the hardest thing in the world. My wife, Kelly, and I have three children, and if you've heard me talk about our kids, my wife before, we have a son who's 22, a daughter who's 20, and a daughter who's 17. These are our three kids. I certainly married way over my head because all of their good looks come from their mom, I promise. But when Kelly and I were thinking about having children, one of the things, Pastor, that we thought was really, really important because of a guy named A.W. Tozer, the most important thing about you is what you think about when you think about God. We felt like when we had kids, the most important thing that we could do is to make sure that they were just theologically just studs. Like their theology and who they were as it related to the way they thought about God, how they could talk about God, all those things. We just wanted to raise kids that were just Tim Tebow Juniors, right? That's what we wanted. And here was the problem with all the people that were in our lives that we thought were raising kids that way. The parents and the kids were rude. They weren't kind. They were very conceited. They were unbelievably judgmental. And so I can remember this distinctly. At some point, Kelly and I looking at each other and going, why don't we just raise kids who love and act like Jesus? And if you're in this room as a parent, I'm not at all implying you need to parent like me or the person sitting next to you, but isn't it probably a good idea that we raise our kids to look and act like Jesus? And wouldn't our world be different if not only our children would be that way, but we would be that way? Wouldn't everything change if that's what we decided to do? And what if we started acting like what a person does can have an effect on what a person believes? And it does. And I know that some of you you're sitting here and you're going, well, you're already raising theologically incorrect kids because our faith is not works-based. And you are absolutely right. But let me remind you of this. James, the brother of Jesus, said this about what it is that you and I do. Don't just be a hearer of the word. Don't just sit there and listen. James said, do what it says. Do what it says. And especially on the front porch of a week where all we do is celebrate gratitude and thankfulness for all the blessings that God has given us. What if we made a pact? What if we decided that we're going to do what Jesus said was the most important thing, and that is to love our neighbor as ourselves. And here's what I know to be true. You, me, the next generation will understand more about God when we start coaching them to be the person that God created them to be, because there is something in the heart of every single one of us sitting here today that knows that when you serve, you help, you're kind, you're compassionate to someone that you do not know or that you do know, and you do it just because you want to do it, something changes in your heart. Something clicks. And I can tell, there are many of you, you're looking at me, and there's this glazed look like, and part of the reason why is because many of us have grown up in faith traditions where what you're supposed to do to be spiritually elite is to just sit and listen and take in stuff. Let me change the game for just a second today. Let's say that instead of loving God the way God created us to love him, let's just say that the issue on the table is mountain climbing, which you have absolutely none of here in Edwardsville, okay? Let's just say the issue is mountain climbing. And if I'm going to teach you how to be a mountain climber, this is what I decide to do to teach you or to help you to become passionate about mountain climbing. First of all, I start thinking, you know what? I'm going to show the movie Cliffhanger, where Sylvester Stallone apparently thought it would be cool to climb a mountain in CPS shorts. That's just gross, okay? But I'll show you the movie Cliffhanger, which was a long time ago, and some of you are like, no, I'm not a Sylvester Stallone fan. That was an awful movie. Cool. I'll show you the movie Everest, which will scare you to death from ever climbing a mountain. Because if you've ever seen this movie, it is absolutely terrifying of what happened on the top of Everest. But I can show you Everest because of the scenery and all the things they get to experience, and that's going to give you a passion for climbing a mountain. And some of you are those people, all of us have friends like this. I like the book better. The book was better. The book was a whole lot better than the movie. You know those people that, you know, you call them annoying. All right, those people. So you're that person, like, the book was better. Cool. Maybe instead of me showing you Cliffhanger or Everest, I'll show you or I'll have you read Into Thin Air, which is an eyewitness account of what happened on Everest when they made the movie Everest. And after you read Into Thin Air, you can go to REI or your local sporting goods store, and you can buy a checklist of all the things that you need to buy and have to be an incredibly passionate climber of mountains. To which none of you in this room are moved. Can I tell you why? You know why people are passionate about climbing mountains? They climbed a mountain. They climbed a mountain. And you know why some of us in this room aren't passionate about serving others? You're not serving. You're not loving your neighbor as yourself. I have so much respect for this man and your leadership team, and I know for a fact that they, week after week after week, this is the heart of God. This is the heart of God. This is the heart of God. And I promise you, they have not prompted me to say this, but you and I will never become passionate about serving other people until you serve somebody. Until you decide, I'm going to serve someone. I'm going to do good. Now watch. And again, for those of us who have gotten the checklist, let me make very, very clear. Doing good is a response to the gospel. It's not a substitute for the gospel. Doing good is a response to the gospel. It's not a substitute for the gospel. Doing good reflects the nature of Jesus. It doesn't earn you points with God. Doing good stretches your faith. It's not a replacement for your faith. But here's what I also know. Doing good, serving others, sparks the image of God in all of us. And here's what I believe with all my heart today. There is a man, there's a woman, there's a teenager, there's a child, there's a college student, a young professional, a single, a grandparent, a boss, a work associate. And you sit here today and the thing, the tinder in your life that is just waiting to be ignited is you doing good. Because it will spark the image in you, your image created in God's image, and miracles will happen because of your life. Here's how I know. Here's a friend of mine that I've met. His name is Ezra French. In 2014, Ezra French was named Sports Illustrated Kid of the Year. For those of you that notice, Ezra French only has one leg. He was born with only a few fingers on one hand. I have another picture of him actually running track. Ezra French, with only one leg, one hand, and other physical handicaps or physical obstacles, is the captain of his basketball team. He plays point guard. He is a decorated track and field star. And all of us in this room, when you look at his limitations, you would go, how in the world? Well, can I tell you why? Because Ezra French has this thing in him called the image of God, and he has tapped into it, and he is starting to do good. I'm not talking about accomplishment. He's decided, I'm going to use my life for something bigger than myself. Here's another picture for you. This kid, his name is Thomas Suarez. Thomas, when he was 12 years old, heard a teacher in one of his classes complaining that they did not have some of the technology that they needed to educate properly in his school system. So Thomas, at the age of 12, developed an app that teachers can use to be better educators. And he began to give it away and also fund other things through that app. The picture that you just saw is Thomas Suarez speaking at a TED Talk. He was 12. What were you doing when you were 12? How in the world? Because he's been created in the image of God. And when you light the tinder, things go crazy. And this one will be a challenge for all of you. This is a picture of Malala Yousafzai, the youngest ever Nobel Peace Prize winner, shot in the face by the Taliban because she stood up for gender equality in her country. Now, here's what's crazy. She doesn't even believe what most of us believe. But can I tell you why she has the capacity to do that kind of good? Because she's been made in the image of God. She's been made in the image of God. And the question that all of us have to ask ourselves is, maybe I have been sitting wanting somebody to tell me the great stories. Doing good invites you into the story. A bigger story than you could even fathom. But why don't we do that? Why don't we do that? I think one of the reasons we don't do it, to be honest, is that it is a whole lot easier to teach people what to believe than it is to coach them how to serve and do good. It's a whole lot easier for someone to stand here or for you to sit and to be taught what to believe than it is for you to do good. I have a very dear friend. Your pastor mentioned that I do a lot of work across the country with student pastors and youth culture. I have a very dear friend who is a student pastor in Rockwall, Texas. And a couple of years ago, a high school student, a male, called him and said, "Hey, man, I really need to talk to you. Can we meet?" And Greg, my friend, said, "Absolutely. We'll meet at Starbucks." And so Greg just reasoned that a high school guy that wants to talk to the youth pastor, one of two things are going on. He has a question about God, or he is struggling morally. He's either got a sex issue or a God issue. And so he put a book in his backpack, a study of the book of Romans, and a book about sex in his backpack to go and meet this high school kid. And he gets to Starbucks, and they sit down to have coffee, and Greg, my friend, slides both books across the table and goes, "Now, which one do we need to talk about?" And this high school kid goes, "I don't need to talk about sex or God. I was wondering if you could help me figure out how to start a nonprofit to help feed the homeless in our community." Greg had been so worried about teaching him what to believe that he had forgotten that he needed to coach him how to serve. Because teaching what to believe is so much easier. Plus, it's not how we measure success, right? The way we measure success is how many people are sitting in here, how many fannies are in the pew, how many baptisms, cheese in the bank. It's not how we measure success. Another problem is it takes more time to serve. I mean, let's be really, really honest. It's easy. We're talking an hour out of your day. But if something changes where your heart begins to become ignited to serve other people, it's going to take more time. It's complicated to organize. And let me tell you why it's complicated to organize. It's complicated to organize because there are real human beings who are in desperate need of love. And here's what I know to be true. As soon as I'm done today, you're going to get in your car or van or whatever you came here, and you're going to already have in your mind people or places or institutions or some families that desperately need you to serve them. And part of the reason why you won't and I don't is because we decide to put everything else on our calendar except to serve. Except to do good. What if you decided this Thanksgiving that you're going to mark at some point every day, every week, every month, I'm going to do good for somebody else. And I'm not going to try to gain praise from it. I just want to do good. And I do need to warn you, it will be messy and it will be risky. The church that I attend in Atlanta, one of our church members is somebody that you may know, a guy by the name of Jeff Foxworthy, who's a comedian. I'm not wearing this shirt because I'm going to tell this story. But Jeff Foxworthy is a member of our church. And last week, our pastor interviewed Jeff Foxworthy because Jeff Foxworthy, for those of you that don't know, the highest grossing comedian in the history of comedy. But you may not know this about him, that every single week, he serves at a homeless shelter in downtown Atlanta and leads a Bible study of homeless men. He's an incredible guy. And last week, he told this story that he had been investing in this group of guys, about 250 guys, for about a year. And he went to the guy who owns the shelter and he said to him, "I think we need to challenge these men and women who are homeless in our shelter to do good. So here's what I'd like to propose to do. I want to give every single man and woman that come to the shelter or are part of this $100. And I want to ask them to go and to do good with that $100. And the owner's like, "Bro, that is the worst idea I've ever heard." And Jeff said, "Okay, cool. I'll make it 50. He gave 250 people 50 bucks. All of them gathered on the same day, and all of these men and women, many of them, he said, started crying as soon as they got the money because they were already thinking, I can go back and visit my family that I haven't seen in years. I can pay off a bill. Or some of them were thinking, I can go and get high again. But then Jeff stood in front of them after he'd given them this money, and he said, for those of you that don't know, we just had a school that burned down about a block from our homeless shelter. This is the coldest winter in the history of Atlanta. It was several years ago. And I'd like to challenge you. You don't have to do this, but I'd like to challenge you. Instead of you using that money on yourself, use it to do good in somebody else's life. Listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. Every man and woman to a man and woman came to the front, put their $50 back in the bucket, and many of them started going to where they sleep and pulling dollars and coins and things out of the stuff that they had to give to those in need. So what's your issue? Why is it that you don't want to serve? How is it that you convinced yourself that this isn't for you? For me, what I know to be true about me is the biggest reason for me is that many times it's just not a priority in my own life. Where are the dads in the room? Dads, raise your hand. Dads, here's how we know that serving isn't a priority many times as men and especially as dads. Because I would suspect that this has probably happened as you've been a dad. That your children have ran upstairs while your wife is in the shower. Precious time to a mom, and knocked on the shower door to get mom's attention just for mom to open up a fruit snack. And when she asked her child, where's your dad? Your child said, he's watching a football game. But the reason why the child ran to mom, it's because the child knew mom would serve. Mom would do good. So where are you? Is there anybody in your life who's in need? Is there somebody who needs you to be a good Samaritan? Well, Stuart, you don't know how bad I've been. Remember what the Good Samaritan was like. You have no excuse. I have no excuse. Well, I just don't have time. None of us have time. It's the biggest cop-out in the world. But somebody is in desperate need of you being a good Samaritan. And not just one day, not just on a holiday. Because Jesus seems to imply it's what matters most. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbor. You talking about as long as they're an Israelite? That's why Jesus used the story of the Good Samaritan. Love your neighbor as yourself. Let me pray for us. Jesus, especially in this season, we want to be, we need to be, and even more importantly, somebody needs us to be good Samaritans in their life. I want to confess to you that there are far too many times in my life where I am a rabbi and I am a priest. And maybe I need to be a little bit more like a despised and outcast Samaritan who sees a need and meets it. Forgive us for sitting and being taught and never going and doing good. And may that be our heart this Thanksgiving. In Jesus' name, amen.